Well, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission is going to meet in regular session tomorrow night, Tuesday, September 13th at 6 o'clock. A couple of items on the agenda we're going to discuss this morning. We should have Amir Cause and Ray Milliner on the phone with us. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Good morning.
Let's start with you, Amir. Let's talk about this Discovery Project. This is near the Wildman School, a mixed affordable housing / market rate housing development. We're talking about 49 single-family units and 46 townhomes near the Wildman School. It's been through some hurdles, it looks like, approved back in 2011 and then a lawsuit involved. Can you give us some background?
Sure. So the project was approved by Summit County Council, not the actual design, but just the number of units was approved by Summit County Council soon after a citizen group sued the county and the developer. The lawsuit was settled with specific conditions to the lawsuit. The applicant came back a year later and applied for the final plat application. And after a few years of going back and forth on the design, they finally submitted a design that meets minimally acceptable design standards.
And at your last work session, you ran out of time. You were talking about this project, and so that's why this is added to the agenda this time for Tuesday night. The planning commissioners had emailed some of their concerns. What was staff's reaction to those?
Those were normal concerns. You know, we understand, and that's why we're going to have our county engineer, and obviously the developer will have their engineering team as well to answer some of these questions that the planning commission had concerns over.
One of the concerns we heard was that the affordable housing units, so you're going to have 46 townhomes, and those are the affordable housing component. Is that right?
Yes. So a part of the 46 townhomes will be affordable housing. Scott Loomis of Mountain Lands plans on developing the rest of them at attainable prices. But in order to meet one of the stipulations of the lawsuits, only a portion of those townhomes can be, just because of the 1.5-to-1 ratio requirement, only a portion of them will truly be affordable, and the rest of them will be privately negotiated as far as attainable prices, but the county would not be involved in something like that.
So any bandwidth you can give us on the prices?
Prices, that would be a good question to ask Scott Lewis.
Okay. One of the other concerns we heard was that there's no variety in style or design of the project. Are there too many large unbroken row houses in this plan?
That is one of the planning commissioner's concerns. We did look at architectural design standards. Facade breaks are being met. For example, buildings that are wider than that are between 60 and 100 feet, you need to have a prominent shift of 10 feet or a series of shifts that equal to that 10 feet. The applicant is achieving that, but we are obviously welcoming those comments, and we're happy to have a discussion.
And what about walkability? There's a concern about excessive cul-de-sacs, that the developer put these in as a wish rather than a need. Are they connected for pedestrians?
So the interesting thing about this project, there's only one way in and one way out. So whether we have a looping road or cul-de-sacs, there really won't be too much difference. Last time we met with the Planning Commission, there was actually sidewalk only on one side of the street. With the engineering requirements and strong comments made by Planning Commission at previous work sessions, the applicant has provided sidewalks on both sides.
And let's talk about how this application differs from the one back in 2011. It's a little bit smaller, isn't it?
Yeah, so the original unit count started off at 105. Due to design restraints, the applicant has reduced that number to 95.
And you say one way in, one way out. Is that a concern for the fire district or emergency vehicle access?
Well, there is a secondary fire access, and it's fire access only. There is pedestrian component to that access, but the fire district is acceptable of that.
And if this goes through Tuesday night, next step is a public hearing. Is that right?
Correct.
And when would that be?
Which is scheduled October 11th.
Okay. And what other concerns have you heard from nearby residents about this project?
So we have not. We received one concern regarding the tree count. Tree count has actually been a tree survey has been provided. But we have not received any other comments so far. Obviously, we welcome public comments, and we welcome the public to come to the meeting. But so far, we have not heard much.
Got it. Thank you, Amir. Let's move on to surveillance cameras in Jeremy Ranch. Ray Milliner, this is your project, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, Jeremy Ranch wants to put in 4 surveillance cameras. Why?
My understanding is they would like to use them as security devices, basically to monitor the neighborhood and make sure everything is safe.
Have there been a lot of security problems there?
Not that I know of. I contact, discussions with, the sheriff's department says there's no more incidents up there than there are in any of the other neighborhoods, per capita. I know that over the years they've had a security company with a vehicle that have driven around, and so I guess they just feel that they would like to have these cameras, for security, or just for a sense of just feeling safe.
And it looks like of the 4 sites, one is right there at the entrance on Rasmussen Road by that convenience store. The second one by the country club.
Yep.
The third by the East Canyon Road, kind of in the back.
Yeah. So they've chosen those 4 spots strategically just because they feel those are kind of, centrally located around the neighborhood. And also they've chosen those spots because they're located next to golf course or, open areas that aren't in front of people's houses so that the visual impact would be reduced on the neighborhood, or at least on the homes, the single-family homes.
The 4th one looks like it's up on Sackett Drive, and that looks like it's surrounded by quite a few single-family homes. And none of these cameras will be pointed at houses?
That's my understanding. We won't be monitoring them, so we won't be setting the where they're viewing, but the intent is to have them basically scanning the roadway so they can just see, monitor suspicious vehicles or people or whatever.
Why is this an item then for the county to approve?
Because this type of a use is listed as a conditional use on our use chart. And so we review it as a conditional use.
So are the cameras actually on county property?
They'll be within the right-of-way. They'll need to get some a facility in the right-of-way permit from our engineering department if this is approved by the planning commissioner.
Has this gone through the county attorney's office? Is this something that video from these cameras would be subject to public records requests if somebody wanted to see them?
That's a good question. We haven't asked the legal department that specific question. I don't know that I'm qualified to give that response. That's a very good question, though.
Did the HOA indicate to you if they had surveyed their residents and that residents approved of it?
I haven't gotten a list or a survey or a vote from the residents. I know that the HOA is authorized to act for and in behalf of the residents in that area, so my assumption is that they have, at the very least, consented to the application. I doubt if it's 100% approval, but at least a majority.
Has the county gone through this with any other HOA?
Not that I know of.
Got it. Anything else you think our listeners need to know about this issue?
No, I don't think so. I think it'll be interesting just to see what happens.
And before I let you go, Ray, quick question. Also on the agenda, this is the work session. No, I'm sorry. This is actually in the regular session. That you guys are going to be talking about the Lyft Hotel, which I understand is only called Lyft Hotel, not the Lyft Hotel, up in Canyons Village. This had come up before the Planning Commission in the past, and there were some concerns. Have you had a chance to look at this report to see if your concerns have been eased?
I have not read that report yet. Tiffany Northrop Robinson is our planner on that one. I've not read her report on it. If it's coming up for a public hearing, my assumption is that the applicant has, at the very least, addressed the concerns that were raised by the Planning Commission at the work session, and then they're ready to kind of vet it out at a public hearing and see if the public agrees with what has been done at the work session.
It's coming up for discussion and possible recommendation, and it's RC22, this is a hotel, a 61-unit condo building that's going to be behind It's going to be behind, not the Grand Summit, but the Sundial.
Vintage on the Strand.
Yeah, between Vintage on the Strand and the Sundial. So this will be dealt with separately, but yet it's part of the master plan, which you guys still haven't seen yet. Is that right?
Correct.
And that's coming up this fall?
That's my understanding, yes.
So is it possible for the Planning Commission to be looking at an individual project prior to looking at the overall master plan?
Well, I think the way that this works is, on this one, there was discussion about just the general use of the property. The overall spa stated that the use on the property is lodging and hotel, and the applicant originally came in with residential uses. And so we went through and we've discussed and modified and looked at that. And so I'm, again, like, not having, like, studied out this report. I'm kind of winging it here. But my understanding is that we'll come back, we'll have a discussion, and see where it goes from there.
Got it, Ray. Thank you. Anything else about tomorrow night's meeting you think our listeners need to know?
No, we just encourage people who are interested to come and voice their opinions so we can, make the best decisions possible.
Joining me now in studio is the director of the Park City Education Foundation, Abby McNulty. Good morning.
Good morning.
What a treat for the students to hear from this author.
Yes, it's going to be wonderful.
What kind of classwork is she going to do?
She comes for 2 days. She'll be here tomorrow morning at the high school, and she'll spend 2 days at the high school, and she works with all the English classes. So every student has read the book over the course of the summer, and then she'll come and speak to every English class, and she'll work with them, and she talked about it in her interview with Leslie. She interacts with the kids, and based on what they're interested in, whether it's the story of the orphan train and the history of that, or whether it's the journey of being a writer, pulling together a novel. She works with the kids based on their interests.
How did you pick her?
It's picked actually by the high school teachers, the high school English teachers, Melissa Nicolai and Kelly Yates lead a group. And they run through books all year long that might be a good fit for the high school and for kids and, resonate with kids. And then they make a selection based on that.
And the authors, you do this every year. You bring somebody in.
We do. It's called the Author in Residence Program. We bring in an author every year. This is our 8th year of bringing in an author. Last year was Boys in the Boat, which was another great read. And every year it's a little bit of – it's a different kind of novel. It's a different kind of book. And the history, the English teachers, believe it or not, are actually working on making next year's selection right now. So, yeah, and I do encourage, if anyone has a great read that they want to recommend that would be appropriate for high school kids, and that has an author that's accessible and that the Ed Foundation could afford to bring here, please send us a recommendation.
How do you raise money for this?
We have individual donors and foundations that support the Author in Residence program, and including Promontory Foundation and the Tom Wilson Foundation. So we're very lucky to have that.
Approximately what's the budget for something like this?
It costs us about $10,000 to bring an author in every year because we have to fly them. We have to Montage generously hosts them for the Ed Foundation. But then we also have to pay a stipend for their time. They earn their keep while they're here. They're meeting with kids all day, every day. And then tomorrow night, Christina Baker Klein will also be doing a presentation to the community. So we also host a free community event at the Jim Santee Auditorium tomorrow at 7. And so that everyone in the community who's participated in this book through the One Book, One Community Read, which is a partnership with the Ed Foundation, the school district, the two libraries, and Dolly's Bookstore, that they can come and have a chance to ask the author questions about her book, too.
And we were just talking while that story was airing that it is a quick read.
Yes.
So you can run out and buy the book today, and you think you can finish it by tomorrow at 7.
I do, yes. As a mom who rarely gets time to read, I have been able to read this book, and it's very quick. It's very entertaining. And so, yes, there's still time.
Well, you have a new program with the Park City Education Foundation called Bright Futures to help first-generation high school students get to college. Tell us about that.
So Bright Futures is a program to tackle a national issue, which is many first-generation students. They enroll in college, but then they have a hard time graduating from college. So nationally, the statistics are anywhere between 11 and 25% of first-generation kids graduate once they enroll. And we're seeing that same trend here in Park City. And first-generation college students are kids whose parents didn't go to college, so they just don't have the vernacular, they don't have the understanding, they don't know how college works, that there's, you know, dormitories, that there's cafeterias, you know, all these things, you know, of what the college campus is like. So Bright Futures was started with the help of a man named Eric Guerin, who's a second homeowner here in Park City. He started a program called Bright Prospect in California 12 years ago. And they set out to address this exact challenge in California. And today, they've been hugely successful. They have a 98% graduation rate of their first-generation students. They have 2,000 kids enrolled. And they work with many school districts across the area of Southern California called Pomona. And so just happenstance, we started conversations with him actually a couple years ago. And this summer, we were able to launch the program, and here we call it Bright Futures. And it's led by a first-generation student herself, also a graduate of Park City High School, named Rebecca Gonzalez. And it launched this summer with a summer academy, 20 kids. It starts when kids are in 10th grade, and it follows them all the way until they graduate from college. So every year, there will be a new class of 10th graders that enter into the program. And so eventually, there will be kids from 10th grade all the way to seniors in college.
And is Rebecca Gonzalez a college graduate as well, or is she still in college?
She's still in college. She's a junior in college. So she's a part-time coordinator of this program, incredibly passionate, wonderful young woman. And we're so lucky to have her in this community.
And how many students did you have sign up for this?
We have 20. So 20 was our first group of kids, and Rebecca will be working with them throughout the course of the year. I mean, she'll be working with them until they graduate from college, really.
And there's kind of a peer mentoring system involved.
Yes. So it's all about teaching kids social and emotional skills, self-advocacy, how to network with their professors, how to seek supports that already exist in our community. I mean, there's tons of organizations like Make a Genius Store that do tutoring, or, you know, all these organizations that are out there. And it teaches kids how to seek those supports to make them successful. And it pairs them in teams called crews. So kids are paired together in groups of 3 to 4, so that they become really reliant on each other, that they help each other. They boost each other up. They say, you know, hey, it looks like you're struggling. You're having a hard time with school. Like, what's going on? Like, how can I help you? And these kids keep these crews all the way through high school. And then when they get to college, they form new crews.
And let's talk about the money behind this. Mm-hmm. How much do you need? How did you raise it? What do you need to keep it going?
Yep. Great question. The program is currently about $40,000 a year. But as we introduce more students into the program, we'll need more people to manage the program, to work with Rebecca side by side. Rebecca right now is part-time. So the program costs will increase. In the next 2 years, we'll see the program costs increase. So we have 2 years of funding. We've been able to do that in many parts, and many thanks to private donors. It's fully privately funded. This is not a program that would fall within a normal K through 12, you know, public education budget, because it really is, you know, supporting kids after they graduate from college, high school. The program in California is run as a totally independent nonprofit organization. But here, we're actually running it out of the high school. Park City Community Foundation had a number of donors who came in and gave us seed funding to help us get our second year off the ground. So we are well funded for 2 years of the program. But then as the program begins to increase is when we will need to raise additional funds.
Let's move on to elementary after-school program. How's the need for that this year? Do you have increased enrollment?
Yeah, there's the program's changed considerably this year, which I think is an exciting change. So the elementary after-school program, it provides an opportunity for kids to have a safe, nurturing, academic, enriched environment after school, so before parents get home from work. It's in all four elementary schools. It serves about 250 kids. Up until this year, there were two programs offered, one run by Community Ed and then one that was run with the Park City School District with support from the Education Foundation and Holy Cross Ministries. And this year, those programs have merged, which is really exciting. So instead of having two parallel programs in the exact same school, now there's just one program. Todd Klarich is the head of Community Ed, who has done all the work to bring those programs together. And they started the first day of school. And I know that there's always some challenges when you are offering a new program and getting things started. But I think it's a really exciting change. Kids will have a really enriched, great working environment for after school.
Is it too late to get your kid registered?
I don't believe it is too late. I know that there was a September 7th deadline for registering, but I can't imagine that if there's a family who needs after-school care that they would, you know, not welcome them.
Yeah, circumstances change perhaps with the parent's work schedule or something. They may need to add it on.
Yeah, and there could be wait lists at individual schools. My children are at McPolin. I do know there is a wait list at McPolin, and they're currently trying to hire additional teachers so that they can serve more kids. But Community Ed is the best place to reach out regarding logistics if anyone's interested in working in the after-school program or in having their kids in the program.
What does Give 180 Beat the Call?
That is our parent appeal campaign for back to school. We ask parents to – we try and encourage every family, 100% of families in Park City School District, to make a donation to the Ed Foundation to support all the programs that we fund, pre-K to, you know, Bright Futures. So a dollar a day for every day a child is in the classroom is $180. And so we encourage parents to make a contribution of $180 per student.
How are you getting the word out about this?
We get it out through the schools, through the PTOs. We have amazing ambassadors. The Ed Foundation has an ambassador at every school, which is a volunteer position who helps us get the word out. We're so lucky with the amount of volunteers that we have and the incredible commitment of our volunteers. It's amazing.
How did the Red Apple Gala go?
It was good. It was great. It was on Saturday night, and it was a lot of fun. It was very successful, and I know everyone's still in a little bit of an event fog this morning as we dig out, but it was wonderful.
Good. You'll plan on doing the same next year?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We do. We have two large events that Ed Foundation does. One is our Red Apple Gala in the fall, and then we do Running with Ed in the spring. So we'll stick with those.
Mm-hmm. And this is your 30th anniversary. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the Ed Foundation's celebrating 30 years of serving kids.
And if people want to get involved, what should they do?
The best way, go ahead and contact me. My email is amcnulty@pcschools.us.
Great. Abby McNulty, Director of the Park City Education Foundation, thanks for being here this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And let's hear more about that road tour with members of the leadership class. Joining us this morning in studio, we have Hilton Early, Matt Lawyer, and Sue Gordhammer. Thanks for being here this morning, you guys.
Thanks. Well, I'll go ahead and kick it off. What I liked about City Tour was really the opportunity to not only as our class meet with city leaders elsewhere, but there was a group of 70 of us, and so meeting city and county leaders, but also staff. We just had some fantastic conversations amongst Park City folks, but then when you mix in Aspen, Snowmass, Basalt, Carbondale, Vernal, we hit five communities. So it was fast-paced, but incredibly informative. It was an amazing experience. Far exceeded my expectations.
And you get a real look behind the curtain of how these cities operate, don't
Absolutely.
You?
I mean, we heard good and bad. And that's another aspect that was so beneficial was not only learning what to do, so lots of conversation around affordable housing and transportation, but also the opportunity to learn from some mistakes that were made, right, so that we don't necessarily repeat them. If we stay in our own bubble, we're not going to be nearly as efficient.
I want to go back to what mistakes you saw. But first, Matt, let's hear from you. What was your biggest impression of City Tour?
I found it to be a profoundly meaningful experience. I felt like Alice Through the Looking Glass. You mentioned five communities. We're all sort of fraternal twins or quintuplets, as it were. And there's all these social, cultural, political, economic slight differences and similarities, and being able to see through that lens when I met people there and have these conversations and see how they do things differently was the reciprocal sharing of ideas was amazing.
Hilton?
I think Aspen especially shares a lot of the challenges that we have here in Park City, except that they're maybe 15 or 20 years ahead of us in their evolution. But when we came in, we spent a whole day with the Aspen community leaders, and then we were able to break off into some specific groups based on our interest areas. But I would say the top three things we heard about that were challenges for them were affordable housing, sustainability, and transportation. And I think anybody listening today would think that those are familiar themes here in Park City. And so they were really able to talk to specific challenges that we were hearing. And I know that in some of the past city tours, the locations have been terrific, but the issues haven't always matched up. And I felt like here with Aspen and then some of the other communities that we saw as well, it was really a terrific match and very informative.
Well, I hate to start off on a negative, but Sue, what was a mistake that you saw one of these communities make that you thought, oh, Park City didn't want that?
I was trying to think of some of the specific, and we certainly didn't dwell on mistakes. And I won't use this as a mistake per se, but in Basalt, we met at the Rocky Mountain Institute, which is just an amazing facility, LEED certified, just a phenomenal structure. And what was there before along the riverfront, and Basalt's unique in that it's the confluence of two just amazing rivers. And they hadn't developed that area at all, and so the town decided they wanted to develop it. And what was there were about 38 mobile homes and people living in very dire conditions. And so, you know, the town had to make a decision to relocate those people. Now, was that a mistake? Initially, it sounded like it was, but the way they went about it was just an incredible story. And so everyone ended up in much better housing. So I won't say that was a mistake, but we talked about some things that, you know, it was kind of hard to hear. Some tough decisions were made. Hilton, you may remember on the sustainability side, there was a program that they said didn't go over real well. And I don't know if it was CORE or, but.
Was that still in Basalt?
No, this was in Aspen.
In Aspen, okay.
Yeah, one of the sustainability projects. They said we tried it, and, you know, we learned it wasn't right for us.
What was there any big takeaway from any of these communities about affordable housing that you in particular, or that you saw city leaders say, aha, light bulb moment, we want to try this in Park City?
So a couple things come to mind for me. For Aspen's affordable housing portfolio is much bigger than ours. And I think that's something it sounds like from council and our leaders here that they're aspiring to grow as well. But it's very complex. So they have up to 7 or 8 different categories based on your income level that you can qualify for. And then that kind of puts you in a slot in terms of what you qualify for. And I think the nuances of it had almost gotten overcomplicated, they said. And so they talked about the importance of getting it right up front so that people can understand it. It's not something you're trying to backtrack on. And then the other piece on affordable housing is it really was a community-wide effort. So the church, the school district, the hospital all had affordable housing on their own campuses for their staff, which allowed them to house them there at a reasonable rate. But I also enjoyed hearing about how they were taking ownership of that challenge for the city.
And Matt, any tangible things that you saw, doesn't have to be affordable housing, that could be implemented in Park City at any of these communities?
So The architecture in Aspen was absolutely phenomenal, and it's celebrated and supported. They go beyond just the traditional, like we have the ribbons on some of the houses here. They have a website called aspenmod.com, so I want to encourage everyone to visit it. It's a great way to spend a few hours.
What does it look like? What's on aspenmod.com?
It talks about the history of the architects and explains how the architecture came to be.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. In fact, you know, like Hunter S. Thompson, the gentleman that made his political poster for his aspirations as sheriff at Aspen, actually was the architect for some of the buildings downtown in Aspen.
And did you see anything that you thought, ooh, doggy, I don't want this in Park City?
Yeah, the Modern Art Museum in Aspen looks like a picnic basket. And that speaks to, not to cast aspersions on Aspen, that speaks to just sort of generally speaking, you know, you can't build a consensus of 100% ever.
So let's talk about Vernal. When we heard that was on City Tour, I think everyone had a bit of a what moment.
As did we. or I can only speak for myself. So Vernal, it was a bit of a culture shock, I'll say, after spending time, right, in Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley. And I did, I can't say I learned anything other than, you know, the dependency on a single source, right? So oil and gas extraction. And it's very clear the roller coaster that Vernal rides. Someone brought up, I think Tim Henney brought up the dependency, the linkage between Vernal and towns like Park City. And I think Rick maybe mentioned it in his piece, right? So we as consumers are the engine that is driving Vernal. And until we back off, all of us, and then help Vernal, you know, look at other options. They have amazing mountain bike trails. They have the dinosaurs. So, but I don't think I got the sense that they really didn't view the tourism and the unique attractions that they have as sort of a real source of income or pride for their community. They're very grounded in the oil and gas.
In some of these more rural extraction-based cities in Utah, like Escalante, where there's so much tourism, you do sense that it's generational. You know, we were always an agrarian society, or we're always an extraction-based society. And to get them to make that shift to tourism and recreation, it's going to take some time. What did you think about Vernal?
I echo Sue's comments, and I think, you know, it's interesting to think about that our history isn't that far different. I mean, we were once based on an extraction industry here, and we reinvented ourselves, and perhaps we may have to go through another evolution down the road if one day tourism isn't what it is today for us. So I think it's important to see that we're maybe our stories aren't as wildly different as we thought. There are some parallels. And I think, as Sue mentioned, it's important that they are focused on the future, and I think they're trying to do that in terms of tourism and dinosaur monument and even solar. I know that our community leaders, Andy Bierman and Tim, were sitting with the Senator Van Tassel and the mayor and city manager from Vernal, and they were talking about this new subscriber solar program coming on from Rocky Mountain Power. And I believe, I'm not an expert on it, but I believe it's a solar area is largely connected directly to a particular area in Utah, and then subscribers in that area can subscribe to it directly. And what if Vernal could be a hub for a new solar installation that was available to some in Wasatch counties, let's say? So I think there's some future collaboration opportunities.
We're running out of time, but real quick, you're all part of the leadership class. And you have a project coming up about voter registration. Is that right?
It's our leadership project. Just to give a shout out to Class 22. So we have an upcoming event.
We think it's the 24th. We're partnering with Voter Rise, and it'll be kind of like a pub crawl on Main Street, registering voters.
Great. Well, thank you, Sue Gordon-Hammer, Matt Lawyer, Hilton Early, for coming in this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.